a few weeks ago, I watched the film about a boy with Darcy and Anna and Hope and Athol. Now, I have said before that I like the film about a boy more than you should. Like, I think it'd be fair to say I am like one of its biggest fans, and maybe that's unwarranted. Maybe it doesn't deserve that. But there's this scene at the end of About a Boy where oh, hello, there's someone just buzz. I think it's just my family being disruptive. So there's this scene at the end of the film where this little lad, Marcus, his mum's been struggling. The film is basically the story of his mum struggling and him trying to sort out her issues. And he decides that the thing that's going to make his mum feel loads better is him singing the song "Killing Me Softly" at his school concert. By himself, unaccompanied. Actually, not quite true. He manages to convince someone to accompany him on a recorder, by paying him £5. So he thinks this great idea is to stand up at a high school and sing "Killing Me Softly" while accompanied by a recorder. Now, as they're watching this, the group that were on before him doing amazing breakdancing, the recorder bottles it. He's like, "This is not for me." He's like, "They're going to crucify us. I am not stepping out there. Have your £5 back." But Marcus is very committed to this. He thinks this is what's going to make his mum feel better. So he steps out onto the stage with a microphone in hand and starts singing "Killing Me Softly," unaccompanied. Now, I'm not going to act it out for you now. I'm sure you're all disappointed, but that's not where we're going here. If it was Michael, we would, but that's not where we're going today. So he starts singing it out, and the there is this kind of jeering and restlessness from this group of teenage, all the crowd of teenagers who are watching this thing. This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life. And then, about a minute into the song, out walks Hugh Grant, electric guitar in hand, and starts strumming along next to him and singing this song with him. And amazingly, for about 30 seconds, people are so shocked that they stop jeering. And he gets this pass, and then when they do start jeering, the great news is they're now jeering at Hugh Grant rather than Marcus. And so Marcus ends up being able to do what he wants to do, without catching quite the level of flak that he would have done before. Now, I tell that story because that scene reminds us of a really important truth that most of us know, which is that there are many things in life which are terrifying to do alone. Many things that actually even seem impossible to do alone, impossible to go through alone, but that might become possible, bearable, maybe even enjoyable if you have the support of someone else. It's that dance class that you would never have ventured into alone, but that you confidently step into with your wife. Not me, I still wouldn't venture in. But theoretically, it's that difficult meeting which you're dreading, but is made better by that colleague who says, "Would you like me to come along with you?" It's that confrontation with a friend which has felt too hard for years, but you're finally willing to have due to the loving support of someone else. I don't know what the example is for you, but my guess is if you rack your brains, you can find one. You can find that story, that experience where you were like, "That was terrifying. That was something I would have never done by myself. But that person going through that with me, going alongside me, supporting me made that possible." Now, as we get back into Acts this week, I just wanted to pause to point out how true that is of the Christian life, of the life that Jesus calls us to, of following him. The Christian life requires us to do things which are difficult, things which may seem terrifying, may even seem impossible to you. You may think, "I could never follow Jesus in this area of my life. How could I ever resist the peer pressure of drinking when out with my friends? How could I ever tell my hostile family member about what I believe? How could I ever face a life of singleness if God doesn't bring someone else who's a Christian who I could be with? How could I ever tell the truth in this situation when the consequences could be so bad?" The Christian life is full of scary, maybe even impossible things for us to do. And yet, many of those things become not only possible but enjoyable when we don't face them alone. So resisting the peer pressure of your friends is so much easier when there's someone else stood next to you resisting it too. My guess is you will have some experience of that. Suddenly you feel bolder, and you find that in obeying God in that situation, you find a freedom from the need to just go along with others and the joy in being able to do what you want to do in that situation. So not only does it become possible, it becomes life-giving suddenly when someone's helping you along with that. Telling the truth is always easier when you've got someone next to you saying, whatever the fallout from this is, I will be there. Whatever the consequences that might come of you telling the truth in this situation, and those consequences might be bad, I will be there to help you pick up the pieces. And suddenly when you tell the truth, when you deal with the fallout together, you find that you're freed from that web of lies that you've got yourself trapped in. And you find that your relationships actually grow and are strengthened by telling the truth in that situation. The prospect of singleness is made not only bearable, but also full of opportunities when you have people around you who you can love and who will love you and care for you and know you and share in the highs of life with you. You see, it's not that these things aren't scary. It's not that they're not difficult things to do. Many of them are. But there is a marked difference between trying to do these things by ourselves and trying to do them with other people. Now the same is true, just so we can get into Acts, because I said that's where we're going to be. So it's not a talk on about a boy, although I could do that talk. But this is, let's get into Acts. Because the same is true of Paul in Acts. It's easy to think of Paul, this early church leader, as this kind of super courageous one-man band who goes out and tells everyone about Jesus and sets up all these churches and gets imprisoned and gets beaten and gets all these, just is so brave and so able. But actually, there is almost nothing that Paul does alone. There is almost nowhere Paul goes without at least one companion. So there's the odd thing, there's a speech in Athens that he does by himself, but that's only because he's waiting for the people to join him. Apart from that, everywhere he goes, he always has people alongside him. You're going to see this from the section we're looking at this week, well, at least the first half of it. So just look at it with me. Acts 20, verse 1 and 6, I'll read it now. So when the uproar had ended, this was a riot that had happened in Ephesus when he was there. So when that has calmed down, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them, said goodbye and set out for Macedonia. He travelled through that area, speaking many words of encouragement to the people, and finally arrived in Greece, where he stayed for 3 months. Because some Jews had plotted against him, just as he was about to sail for Syria, he decided to go back through Macedonia. He was accompanied by Sopater, son of someone, Pyrrhus, from Berea, Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica, Gaius from Derbe, Timothy also, Tychicus and Trophimus from the province of Asia. These men went on ahead and waited for us at Troas. But we sailed from Philippi after the festival of unleavened bread, and 5 days later joined the others at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. So you'll have seen it there. It's like in the middle of that section. Look at all those people who are accompanying Paul. Sopater, Aristarchus, Secundus, Gaius, Timothy, Tychicus, Trophimus. And what's interesting is all these people from all these different places who accompany Paul. And what we know from Paul's letters that he writes is the affection that he has for these people who are his companions in different places. He describes them as co-workers. He describes them as fellow soldiers. He describes them as brothers and sisters and sons. He describes them as people who provided him with what was lacking. Paul goes basically nowhere without a companion, and even when he's in prison, which he spends a reasonable amount of time in prison, he is visited and supported by these people. And so what Paul finds is that even something as scary as prison, with the prospect of execution at the end of it, that's where the prison story is heading, that becomes more bearable through the support of others. Now, the point here is obvious, but let me spell it out just so we don't miss it. if you are wanting to face the impossible, scary job of following Jesus in a world which is constantly telling us not to bother, constantly telling us that we'd be better off pursuing something else, if you are going to maintain integrity in a world full of temptation and pressure, if you are going to experience the joy of the gospel in amongst all the brokenness of this world, which is very real, then you are going to stand a much better chance with Christians by your side facing it. That's all I'm saying. Nothing more radical or extreme than that. If you are going to follow Jesus, experience the life, the rest, the joy that he offers, you are going to have a much better chance of doing that in this world if you have Christians alongside you. That's why we think church is so important. That's why we came and planted Grace Church, because trying to follow Jesus without the support of a church is likely to seem not only scary, but impossible at times. That's why we think getting together on a Sunday like this is so important, because trying to love and enjoy Jesus without corporate teaching, corporate worship, corporate prayer, that is going to feel pretty difficult a lot of the time. That's why we think life groups are important, because trying to obey and prioritize Jesus in a world of distractions is going to be difficult and scary without a diverse group of Christians around you supporting you. I'll have told this story a number of times, but let me just repeat, because I find it's impacting me a lot. When I was working in Leeds, I used to work in the city, and then I'd walk home from work and I'd get into the house at 6:45, and our life group would have already started and we hosted it in our house. And so I'd get into this full house, and often on the walk home, I would be thinking, man, I wish my house was going to be empty when I got home. Like, that is what I'd be thinking. And I'd be full of the thoughts and concerns of work and all the various pressures that were kind of leaning in on me. But what I found happened almost invariably during the night was I found a different perspective on my life. It wasn't that the pressures went away. It wasn't that the difficulties went away. It was just that fixing my eyes on God, on the life he gives me, on what he calls me to, changed my perspective on all of those things. Without that, I think I'd have, by Wednesday, been pretty stressed, by Thursday, been even more stressed, by Friday, been even more stressed. Because I've had nothing to take my eyes away from what is immediately in front of me and go, wait a minute, let's look outside of yourself. Let's look to who God is, what it means to know him. That's why we think life groups are important. Because when you get around other Christians, when you spend time meditating and thinking about those things, it changes your perspective on what you're going through. And fundamentally, this is why we think Christian friendships are important. Because trying to obey and going through all the things, the challenges of obedience, but also going through loss or failure, these things may well feel crushing without Christian friends to help you through it. Or to take Paul's example here, what's Paul trying to do? Trying to tell people about Jesus? That feels so much more scary when it's you by yourself than when it's you and a few people saying, hey, let's tell you about what we've come to know in the person of Jesus. If we want to share good news of Jesus with people in Hartlepool, which we do, it's why we set up Grace Church, we stand a much better chance of together than apart. So that's what we see in this kind of first section. We see yet again Paul prioritizing, how do I get these people around me so I'm not by myself going out trying to live this Christian life, trying to follow Jesus in a hostile world, but I'm going, what does it look like to have people around me who can walk that journey with me? And I want to challenge all of you, what does that look like for you? What does it look like for you to have companions, you know, for you to have these people like Sopater, like Gaius, like Timothy, these people who are going to go, hey, I see what you're going through, and I'm going to walk that path with you. And that might be for a period of time, or it might be for your whole life. But if you're going to live out your Christian life, the pattern is always you will do that better when you have people around you. So that's the first half of this section. I want to get on to this second story. Let me read it to you. It goes from 7 down to 12, so it's just the next section. On the first day of the week, we came together to break bread. Paul spoke to the people, and because he intended to leave the next day, he kept on talking until midnight. There were many lamps in the upstairs room where we met. Seated in a window was a young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on. When he was sound asleep, he fell to the ground from the third story and was picked up dead. Paul went down, threw himself on the young man and put his arms around him. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "He's alive." Then he went upstairs again and broke bread and ate. After talking until daylight, he left. The people took the young man home alive and were greatly comforted. I've got to be honest, this is one of those stories which when you've read it in the Bible, you kind of don't forget it. Like, everybody's like, "Oh, do you remember that story where that guy falls out the window and dies?" Because the guy preached too long. It's too easy, right? There's too much ground for comedy in it. And it's told in a humorous, even disrespectful way. So, you know, that phrase, "and Paul went on and on." You know, this is the Apostle Paul we're talking about here. And we're describing him as going on and on. Like, it seems a little disrespectful. But whilst the story is memorable told in an entertaining way, I've got to be honest, when you read it, I'm not overly sure what am I supposed to do with it. Like why, of all the stories that could be included in Acts, is this story included? There are surely many stories of things that happened during the establishment of the early church that could have been included, but this one was included. And of course, the story goes on. So he falls out the window. Paul grabs him and in a kind of sort of echoes of Elijah, throws himself on the young man, who then comes back to life, so that apparently Paul can then carry on. He's like, "I wouldn't want this to interrupt me." So it's like midnight. I'm going to go till daylight. And so he presses on because he's going to leave the next day. I've recently been reading a book about, it's called The Escape Artist. It tells the story of a German man who manages to escape from Auschwitz. It's an incredibly brutal read. It's really, really difficult to read. And I'm currently giving myself some light relief alongside it by reading a book called Faith, Hope and Carnage. But as you read, the guy's called Rudolf Werber, as you read his reflections on life in Auschwitz and a story of many, many failed escapes, both by him and by other people who were then executed, the question is, what are you supposed to do with that book? Like, how are you meant to read it? How are you meant to understand it? Are you meant to read it as a manual of how to escape concentration camps, in case you ever happen to find yourself in one? Like, probably not. Partly because it's extremely unlikely that you are going to find yourself in a concentration camp, but also because that's not the book he's trying to write. In fact, there's loads of things that happen in the book that he just randomly manages to get away with. You know, he just randomly luck favors him and he manages to escape to kind of really, really kind of dire situations. You see, the book is not there to say, to teach us, this is how you should go about living in Auschwitz, or this is what you should be trying to do. It's not that. It's telling the story of his experience in Auschwitz. All the things which eventually came together to enable his escape. The point of the story isn't, this is how you should do it, or this is how it should have been done. It's simply telling a story. It's the story of his time in Auschwitz and his escape. Now, the reason I just wanted to use that as an example is because the same principle applies to the book of Acts. Acts is not a book trying to tell us what the normal Christian life should look like. That is just, it's just not what Acts is. Acts is not a manual of this is how you live the Christian life. It's telling the story of how Jesus continued to build his church in the years after his ascension. So Luke, who wrote the book of Acts, is not telling us what we should expect, but rather just showing the amazing work which Jesus began to do here in Acts in building his church. Now, the reason I mention this is because many people read the book of Acts as if it is meant to describe the normal Christian life. But I'd suggest that this passage here is perhaps one of the clearest examples where this is unlikely to be the case. You see, you may be someone who reads the book of Acts and thinks we should expect the same. We should expect miraculous handkerchiefs and healings and all these signs that accompanied everything. Miraculous escapes from prison. All these things we read about in Acts, you think, yeah, that's what we should expect. But even people who think that from my experience, don't expect to see dead people raised back to life. That's not what they expect. So they don't read this and say, oh, well, next time someone dies, what I should do is I should throw myself on them and they'll just come back to life. Like, that's not what we think. So if we don't think it about this, why do we think it about everything else? It's a misunderstanding of what the Book of Acts is. When someone dies, we don't pray for them to be raised, but rather we look forward to the future resurrection, which is promised for all Christians, and which these little tokens that that happened in history pointed to. You see, why would we draw the line here, but not somewhere else? I don't particularly know, but I guess it's because they don't see resurrections happening all around them. So you can't hold that position because it just doesn't happen. You see, just to make it clear what I'm saying, there is a fundamental difference between saying this is something which God has done in the past, maybe even saying this is something which God could do, to saying this is something we should expect God to do. They are three very different statements. As we look at the Book of Acts, we see what God has done. And because of that, we have certain beliefs about what God could do. But we don't then take that next step and say, therefore, this is what we should expect God to do. Because it's not what the Book of Acts is. Luke is never setting out to present us with a template for each of our Christian lives. He's just telling the story of what Jesus did in the beginning as he built his church and encouraging us that throughout our lives, we will continue to see Jesus continuing to build his church. So that leaves us with the question of all the stories he could have told, as I asked before, why this one? Why include this? And surely the answer is because, like the story of Lazarus, it's included as a reminder of the resurrection which awaits all Christians. In 1 Corinthians, Paul will write these words: but Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. And so here we have Eutychus, this young man who falls asleep and is raised. And that acts for us as a powerful reminder of what awaits each one of us. There will come a day when each one of us will fall asleep. But just like Eutychus, this sleep, which seems so final to us now, will prove to not be final at all. No, we will wake from the sleep of death, and we will share in the resurrection which Jesus won for us on the cross. Paul goes on to say that in Christ, all will be made alive, but each in turn. Christ the first fruits, then, when he comes, those who belong to him. That's what Paul says. So what Eutychus partially experienced here, we will fully experience, but in our turn. Not immediately after our death. We don't die and immediately come back to life. Not even 3 days after, as with Jesus. But rather, what does Paul say? When he returns. You see, this is what we're meant to do. We're meant to read the story of Eutychus. And we're meant to dream of a world where dying is nothing more than going to sleep. Where death is not the end. Where it's not permanent. And as we find ourselves longing for that, wishing that that was the world we lived in, but feeling like it's not, we're meant to remember the great hope of Christianity. That death truly is not the end. That in one sense it is truly just like going to sleep. And that when we wake, we will see Jesus and be with him in the perfect world he died to create. You see, this is just a story that's included because it's a picture, it's a shadow of the central story of Christianity, a story of death and resurrection. That's what lies at the heart of Christianity. That's the heart of Jesus' story. And here we see a shadow of it, a little pale imitation of it that reminds us of the main event. This is a story of a man who experienced a power that was stronger than death, a life which couldn't be snuffed out even by dying. And this is the hope that we are supposed to know as Christians. And so you read this story. And I guess I'll leave it with this question. If you're someone here who's looking into Jesus, thinking about Jesus, maybe doesn't follow him for yourself, but just exploring, I guess the obvious question that this leads us to is, what is your hope in the face of death, and is it enough? That's always the question that Christianity has asked. Christianity is primarily concerned with two major problems that humanity face, sin and death. That's the story of Christianity. That's what it's about. It starts with that story. It tells that story all the way through. That's the issue that it cares about. And so the question is, if you're looking into Jesus, if you're not going, okay, I find hope in Jesus, then you've got to face those two things and go, okay, how do I face those things? How do I think about those things? Where is my hope in the face of those two things? If you are someone here today who follows Jesus, knows him, then here's the challenge, and it's not an easy challenge, is to hold on to that hope and to allow that hope to help you through the highs and lows of life. That those trials and joys that come to allow you through all those times to remember that hope of the resurrection, which you will one day share with. I think that's what we're meant to do with this story. We're meant to come face to face with one of humanity's great enemies. We're meant to see this picture of a victory over it. And we're meant to go, that in some way points us to that great victory that Jesus won on the cross. Let me pray, and then I'll tell you how we're going to respond to this.